The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
We want to build a long-term business. We're looking for long-term relationships. We think we can be part of a portfolio for years. And as we, you know, have a proven track record and grow our assets, then we'll do quite nicely. I think now is a great time. Again, we're seeing major inflection points unfold here in some fundamentals. And I don't think it'll be too awfully long until the markets have to come to terms with the changing environment.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, and I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Dave, as a continuation of last week's program, people were wanting to have more detail on the strategy that Doug Nolan specializes in.
We've done two things. One, we've created a four-part video series to kind of explain what, how, why the tactical short works. That is the newest offering from McIlvaney Wealth Management, managed by Doug Nolan.
Well, how can listeners see those?
If you go to mwealthm.com, you can view those videos. Also, if you're interested in having more of a conversation with us about that offering and may want to engage us in that fashion, then I would suggest that you join us for a conference call.
Yeah, no, that's a conference call, and that's taking place at the end of the month, March 30th.
The details of that are also on the website, but set aside some time. You'll need to register ahead of time, and there are limited spaces available, capping that at about 1,500 listeners for the conference call that'll be on March 30th.
Well, and of course, Doug Nolan has been a guest of ours through the years, and Doug has been someone that we've read for decades, and now he's on the team.
We're honored to have him on the team.
Doug, you have 25, actually more than that, but over 25 years experience finding short opportunities. And that is to say, ways of taking advantage of volatility, making money when the prices of an asset or sector goes down. Could you start with exploring what is your theoretical framework?
Sure. And the theoretical framework starts with this macro perspective, top-down analysis, that credit is critical, that finance drives economies, that financial conditions are key to market dynamics. So my framework, you know, I start with the big picture. How aggressive is credit being grown? And then I look at risk intermediation. I'm looking for distortions in the marketplace. A lot of focus on speculative leverage, because in a bull move, you know, that's a self-reinforcing mechanism for adding liquidity to the market when speculators leverage in various securities markets. And that also creates the vulnerability and the potential for, you know, a tightening of financial conditions if you have speculative deleveraging. So a lot of the framework, it's, you know, the top-down credit, financial conditions, and then the market dynamics, looking for, is the market leaning risk on or risk off? And depending on that analysis, that has a major impact on how I want to be positioned on the short side in the marketplace.
You have a story. You are a small town guy from Oregon and got a CPA designation and went to work as a treasury analyst with Toyota. And this goes back to 87. A part of your story is things that you saw for the first time and were sort of these moments of epiphany where you're like, oh, that's interesting. This is fascinating. Oh my. And so from an educational perspective as a CPA, you're seeing things. And as a treasury analyst at Toyota, 1987 rolls around and we've got a market crash in October. Again, this is before you got your MBA and began working on the short side of the market. But I can imagine that you saw some interesting and curious behavior in the markets late in that year. Tell us about that.
Sure. And I feel like I'm the luckiest guy in the world because I was a Pricewaterhouse CPA, and at college at Oregon, I was an accounting finance major, and I didn't like accounting at all. But fortunately, someone convinced me along the way that it was a good background. And the accounting background has been key to my analysis of money and credit all along, because, you know, we're just talking about debits and credits here in this massive global general ledger. But getting back to 1987, yeah, I moved from Portland down to LA, filled up my little car and went down and was a treasury analyst. Lucky break during 1987, sitting in front of a Telerate machine there on the treasury desk, watching interest rates spike and currency chaos. And then the 1987 stock market crash. And I remember I was focused more on fixed income back then, watching bonds rally 11 points in one session. It was just amazing. So I was fascinated by the markets, the macro analysis. Very, very interesting time to work for a major Japanese corporation in 1987. Well, it was 86 and 87. There was a lot of concern by management at U.S. Toyota as far as the bubble in Japan. There were, you know, major concerns of a crash in 86 and 87. And actually, it looked like the Japanese bubble was in the process of collapsing in 87. But, you know, central banks reversed that, and that bubble inflated spectacularly for another 2 years before it burst in 1990. So I became very interested in the dynamics of bubbles when I was at Toyota. And then that interest followed me to my MBA at Indiana and then with my career on the short side.
In the 90s, you were working with Kurt Rischebacher, doing some writing for him. What was one of the greatest lessons you learned when you were working with Kurt?
Yes, you know, the good Dr. Rischebacher, what fond memories. Another lucky break. I started reading the Rischebacher letter in 1990 and was fascinated. He had a perspective that I found nowhere else. That certainly piqued my interest in Austrian economics. And Dr. Rischebacher was always, look first at credit, look first at credit. So that was beginning my interest and deep dive into credit theory, Austrian economics. And so I got the idea that I would fax a letter to Dr. Rischebacher with some, my thoughts on the U.S. markets and credit and the economy. And I also asked him for a photograph that I kept on my desk for years. And then we exchanged a lot of faxes, and he asked if I would like to help write his letter. And I couldn't. I was just working such long hours in the hedge fund industry. And then in 1986, I just decided, yeah, I would love to. So then I think it was 5 or 6 years I assisted Dr. Rischebacher with his monthly letter, and great experience for me, and learned a tremendous amount from, you know, one of the great economists.
Look first at credit, look first at credit. Well, time in the hedge fund industry in the 90s was probably a bit different than the mutual fund industry in the 2000s, where you ultimately migrated to. What did both of those experiences teach you that you bring into our latest endeavor on the short side, the tactical short?
Sure. And the hedge fund industry, what an experience that was in the 1990s. My first year working with Gordy Ringon, we were up 63%. And, you know, we were the geniuses. We had it all figured out. I was going to be wealthy and all of that. And it didn't turn out that way. The Federal Reserve in particular, you know, 1991 lowered interest rates aggressively. They reflated the system. So I spent a lot of sleepless nights trying to understand how this impaired banking system could morph into this new and improved new age financial system in prosperity and bull market. So for me, the hedge fund experience was analytically just invaluable for diving in and trying to understand the dynamics driving inflating asset prices in a growing economy. Invaluable. And a lot of sleepless nights trying to figure out how do you manage short exposure better in such an environment. The old model, the old hedge fund model, concentrated positions where we knew the companies better than the longs, that was not working. All of a sudden, there was liquidity for basically any company that wanted to borrow. If they couldn't tap a bank, they would do a securitization in the marketplace. So it completely changed the rules of finance as we started to get into securitizations and Wall Street finance. So short exposure had to be managed differently. And then for me, it's been a constant learning experience over the years, just trying to do the job better, try to manage risk better, trying to understand the environment. So it's always a learning process. It's a challenge, but it also, you know, I'm excited about it every morning when I wake up. It doesn't get more interesting than this type of work.
Would you say that your experience with mutual funds, the primary issue in that 15, 16 year period, was having a mandate that kind of left you hogtied? I mean, there's only certain things that you can do according to a mutual fund mandate, and it might not be flexible enough to avoid getting run over by the market.
Right. And when I went to work in the mutual fund industry, I certainly made some changes. We needed to be highly liquid because you have inflows and outflows. So that was a big change in the nature of managing short exposure. The hedge fund, at first, we didn't concern ourselves very much with liquidity. We didn't have those daily inflows and outflows. So I had to refine that part of the strategy significantly, working for a mutual fund where we have the flows. But yeah, we had some flexibility, but certainly not the type of flexibility you need when you have these enormous moves in the market and where you just need to get out of the way. And that's something, you know, we're going to certainly do differently now with our new tactical short product.
In a crisis, all kinds of actions are acceptable. And, you know, we talked about 1991, Federal Reserve lowering rates, reflating the system. And in spite of an impaired banking system at the time, they were able to kind of hold things together. And today we've got the genie, which has somewhat gotten out of the bottle. We've got unconventional monetary policies, which seem like they're here to stay. Does that present a problem for a short strategy? I mean, what you're telling me is that the Federal Reserve has been sort of a backstop, what became known as the Greenspan put through the late 90s and early 2000s. This has been around as a problem, continually reflating an impaired banking system. Can you have a successful short strategy in an era of unconventional monetary policy?
Well, you certainly cannot ignore policymaking. And I learned in 1991, do not ignore central bank efforts to reflate the system. In a way, it creates opportunities. It creates challenges. We had a very good run on the short side, you know, 2000, 2001, 2002, and even 2007, 2008. And those opportunities were created from the reflation from the tech bubble. And this reflation we've seen over the last 9 years now has created opportunities unlike anything I've ever seen in my career. I actually thought the biggest opportunity of my career was going to be, you know, the bursting of the mortgage finance bubble. Back in April of 2009, I started warning in my blog about the inflation of the global government finance bubble, the granddaddy of all bubbles. I never imagined it would go, you know, 9 years and central banks would have QE of, you know, 10, 12 trillion and interest rates would basically be at zero for 9 years. But the excesses and the distortions in the marketplace are unprecedented. So yes, daily challenges, navigating around these types of policy responses, but it also creates extraordinary opportunities on the short side.
You know, speaking of central banks, I spoke with a British central banker, Charles Goodhart, on the Weekly Commentary a while back, and it was kind of a dismissive comment. I was talking about the growth in central bank balance sheets, and he seemed to think that the techniques like sterilization were sufficient to prevent inflation, even in the context of rapidly expanding bank balance sheets, ever loosening credit. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think sterilization is part of the way things used to work. Now, you know, central bank balance sheets grow, they add liquidity, and there's no shrinking of that balance sheet. And once the liquidity is out there, it just swirls around in the system. We've seen tremendous inflation, and this gets back to Dr. Rishabhasha, where Dr. Rishabhasha always said, okay, find the credit growth and then try to determine where the inflation is. And it may be in consumer prices, it may be in trade deficits, or it may be in asset prices or corporate profits, right? There's many places where you can have an inflation. And what central banks have specifically done since 2009 is to reflate, add liquidity, and direct it into the securities market. So they certainly have done nothing to reverse that inflation. So they haven't sterilized anything. I do think their challenge going forward will be different in that now we have inflation pointing up globally here in the US, China, Europe. It's been pointing down for a number of years. So that's going to make their decisions to add more QE and to backstop the market more difficult. And we'll just have to see how it develops.
We think we understand what normal is. Bill Gross, a few years ago, started talking about a new normal and sort of a redefinition of normal. And I think QE globally is still fairly robust. Is that a factor that stays, or do financial markets normalize in the future around more traditional supply and demand dynamics? We've had the central bank community as a whole as the buyer of last resort. And I mean, again, do we go back to the old world? The old, what we consider to be normal, where you've got investors who represent supply and demand.
Well, I remember when PIMCO came out with the new normal analysis, and I titled one of my bulletins, The Newest Abnormal. To me, it was just another bubble. You know, we went from, I think we doubled mortgage credit in just over 6 years, and then we doubled federal debt in four, and, you know, we've doubled it since. Yeah. I mean, the history of monetary inflations, you know, you can add money or whatever you want to call it today, liquidity, credit. You inflate price levels and then good luck trying to remove that monetary inflation without deflating price levels. And that's the dilemma. I mean, we're basically at peak QE today, right? We still have 80, 85 billion a month from the ECB currently. We still have probably that much, perhaps even more coming this year from the Bank of Japan. China, this isn't QE, but China had a half a trillion, and that's in US dollars, credit growth for the month of January. So to me, those are the three main sources of monetary inflation. We have, you know, decent credit growth here in the US, but you have this enormous amounts of QE globally, and you have Chinese credit. We know enormous amounts of money is fleeing China. Money's coming out of Europe. Money's coming out of Japan. It's going into King Dollar. So we don't need QE here in the US because of all the liquidity coming globally from QE. I don't think it normalizes. I don't think you can just turn the taps down. We've seen central bankers try to do this, right? We saw that they call it the taper tantrum. I think it was in 2013. They start talking about reducing QE and the markets, you know, have a flash crash. And then Chairman Bernanke comes out and uses this terminology that the Fed will push back against any tightening of liquidity, of financial conditions. Well, any tightening of financial conditions, that means any deleveraging, de-risking in the marketplace. So he basically said, we won't allow a bear market. We won't allow liquidations in the market. And that's where they're kind of trapped right now. And right now we see a parabolic in the stock market. And we saw last year a parabolic in the bond market. And that just increases the probability of a challenging market reversal. Yeah. So good luck trying to normalize it at this point.
It doesn't end differently. The periods of asset price inflation, the consequence of normalization is to lower asset prices, which intrinsically is to say we would have a deleveraging event. And that's why central banks don't want to see normalization. I feel like they've got a rabbit breeding program and they keep on pulling new rabbits out of the hat unexpectedly. And it goes further and further and further than anyone anticipated. When does it end? I mean, this is like musical chairs. It ends when the music stops. I mean, we just keep on playing. We play, and we hope for a chair. Timing seems to be one of those very challenging things because you're dealing with market psychology, and it doesn't necessarily have to be ruled by reason, which means that it could end in the next 2 minutes or the next 24 months, somewhere in between, perhaps.
Sure. And I think a theme for 2017 is that the markets, and these are speculative markets, very speculative, are vulnerable to an unexpected tightening of monetary conditions globally. And from that, I think the ECB is going to be forced to pull back on QE, and the Bank of Japan will also. And I think China, they've got to rein in their credit excesses. It's completely out of control. And I don't think the markets are really prepared for this right now. We're starting to see signs in the European bond market. We're certainly seeing a pickup in inflation. Meanwhile, the markets are ignoring it, these fundamental dynamics, this fundamental deterioration. But I remember the markets ignored problems. The markets rallied to all-time highs right before the Russian collapse and the LTCM debacle in 98. You had this melt-up in technology stocks in early 2000 in the face of rapidly deteriorating industry profits. And then let's not forget, we had the markets rally to all-time highs in later on in 2007, even after the subprime collapse. So this is not unusual that over-liquefied speculative markets do this last run right when fundamentals are starting to change.
So on the issue of inflation, we've spent nearly a decade flirting with deflationary collapse. Certainly that's been the central bank community's primary fixation. A pivot towards inflation, or at least a shift in the marketplace in inflationary expectations, may be here. What are the implications in a highly leveraged world? And can we assume that inflation brings with it higher interest rates?
Sure. A key part of my analysis, my analytical framework, is the importance of leverage speculation in securities markets. And when you have a lot of leverage, you're creating liquidity. You basically create new liquidity out of thin air through borrowing to hold speculative positions in securities markets. I'm convinced that there is enormous amounts of leverage in fixed income globally. And if we do have this inflation dynamic unfold where you have central bankers cautious now, raising interest rates, I'm not as willing to come quickly with more QE, then I think you start a deleveraging within fixed income, and that's global. We had the speculative melt-up in bonds last year in global bond markets, and you've had an important reversal. We already see Italian yields, French yields up 40 basis points so far this year. It hasn't been problematic because we still have this enormous amounts of QE globally. So this new QE kind of accommodates the early part of deleveraging. But all of a sudden, if you take away that QE, you have a whole different environment where there's a lot of pressure on those leverage players to de-risk and deleverage because they'll be worried about future liquidity issues. So I think we're only an announcement from the ECB or some caution from what is a very risky strategy from the Bank of Japan to a lot of leverage players saying, wait a minute, we got to manage our risk a lot differently. And that totally changes the game because, you know, de-risking, deleveraging, that's self-reinforcing.
You know, you mentioned something a moment ago, peak QE, and it makes me think of peak debt, where you find where the pressure is when you begin to see interest rates rise and you've increased a massive amount of debt in the system. If inflation is a real issue on the horizon, what can be said about the massive quantities of debt issued in recent years by corporations and sovereigns? Because generally the idea of inflation for the indebted, it's not bad. You're paying off debt with cheaper and cheaper currency units. But if you think about the structure of that debt, short durations and rollover risk, it seems like those are relevant factors in terms of the integrity of the debt markets.
Absolutely. Part of the credit bubble thesis is if you continue to expand credit, the next year you need to expand more credit to kind of validate that pyramid of credit that you're creating. And all of a sudden, if you don't create enough credit, then you have, you know, debt issues and it's self-reinforcing like we saw back in 2008, 2009. In the marketplace, as long as you're adding leverage, you're increasing the amount of speculation in the market, those prices continue to go up. And that can be homes in, you know, 2006, or it can be bonds in 2016. The problem is, you know, to keep this game going, global central bankers took interest rates even negative, right? How much further negative can they go? They took QE to $2 trillion annualized, and we're numb to that, right? But these numbers are so incredible that I really think that that was kind of the final desperate measure that they were, you know, trying to hold the system together. And now what they've done is they've created highly speculative bubbles in the securities markets, and inflation dynamics have turned. So now what do they do? And I think they're going to turn more cautious. And again, that's part of the 2017 major inflection thesis.
It was really interesting to me to see the dialogue shift. 2015, 2016, as we moved towards negative rates, all of a sudden, partway through 2016, you start seeing the popularization of the idea of going cashless, moving towards an entirely debit and credit system where currency is no longer needed. And it's interesting to me because, you know, classically, when you get into a real financial pickle, you can inflate away the problem. You can default on your obligations. In some instances, you'll see governments get desperate and start stealing assets, nationalization of properties and things. But in this case, financial repression came to the fore, and the smartest guys at the Ivy League schools started writing about how if we're going to carry forward this theme of financial repression, we're going to have to get rid of cash. It wasn't a coincidence. We're in a negative rate environment, and your opt-out as an investor is to get out of the financial system and literally put stuff in the mattress. I mean, I saw a couple of hedge fund managers in late 2015, early 2016 say, you know what? Because we're in a negative rate environment, it makes more sense for me to have pallets of high denomination euros and rent a space, a public storage unit, and just store it there and have an armed guard watch it and have an insurance policy with Lloyds on it. All of my expenses, it's better. I'll come out ahead financially rather than engage in this repression. I guess why I bring that up is because, we're talking about rabbits and unconventional monetary policy. Maybe we see unconventional fiscal policy. To what extent does government sort of have their interests tied to Wall Street and sort of a continuity plan where, I know this is sort of outside of your realm of expertise, but I'd like you to speculate on, does the world look more free or less free as governments try to keep the status quo in play?
Well, clearly it's less free. And you touched on the experiment with negative interest rates and all the distortions that was causing or is causing. And I think central bankers realize that. And they also realize that negative rates, it's not good for the financial sector, and they have to protect the financial sector. So I don't think rates will continue to go negative. We're seeing a lot of changes, you know, social, political instability. And that's part of this shift away from just inflating securities prices and creating liquidity and inflating markets to now the shift is, okay, we need to inflate the earnings of our workers. We need to return industry to the U.S. And that in of itself is a major inflection point with consequences for inflation, right? We're going to import less cheap goods from China and Asia. We're going to manufacture things more here. There'll be taxes probably on a lot of imports. And that changes the inflation dynamic. It'll be interesting because I don't think central bankers are excited about this change. I think they liked it before where they kind of controlled inflation dynamics and they focused on the markets and they kind of mastered the art of stabilizing or inflating markets and backstopping markets. And they thought that they could control economic output through the markets. And all of a sudden they have these politicians that, you know, have very different ideas as far as how they want inflation to go. So we'll see now if central banks become more cautious and if they're willing to accommodate these more aggressive fiscal policies and deficits, especially in an environment of rising inflation. It's too early to tell, but my instincts tell me that the central bank is going to be more cautious with QE going forward. And it's not just the liquidity. It's that promise, that commitment to adding liquidity if the markets need it. And as long as the markets are comfortable that QE is there on demand, then they'll leverage, they'll take risk. And if they question that backstop, then all of a sudden they're not going to take as much leverage or they're going to be more risk averse.
So 2 points. One, it sounds to me like you're saying the Fed may be a different organization under the Trump administration. And I guess as a complement to that, second point, what are your expectations of the new Treasury Secretary?
It's fascinating. You know, our president talked a lot about the bubble during his campaign. I think he and his staff are sympathetic to this type of bubble analysis. I think they understand, they recognize that central banks experimented with money printing and that that inflated markets and created a lot of distortions and a lot of the problems that they now want to reverse. So I don't think, you know, the Trump administration is going to get along that well with the Federal Reserve. And at this point, our president, he likes to note that the stock market's at record highs, and he'll play that game right now. But his motivation is not higher stock prices. He wants to change the economic structure. And I don't think that major change will suit, you know, the markets that well or central bankers.
So the confusion then on the new Treasury Secretary, because on the one hand, you've got a Goldman guy who may be sympathetic to sort of the old way of doing things, the Fed accommodating asset price inflation and general market stability, providing a liquidity backstop. But you've got also the man in the Oval Office talking to the new Treasury Secretary saying, we're going to re-engineer the economy. Is he capable of doing that? Or can you have one man with two agendas? Yes, sir, I'll do that, sir. And then, you know, make sure that you take care of your old Rolodex and your old employer.
My guess is they're determined to really change the economic structure. And whether it's the new Secretary of the Treasury or our president, I think that they believe the system we've been on for years now is unsustainable. And I think they believe that this was heading for some type of a crisis, potential financial collapse, or at least a crisis. So as they unfold their agenda, I think they'll be willing to take a risk with the markets. They seem very determined to me. They don't like king dollar. They don't like these big trade deficits. I don't think that they like QE and the manipulation of markets that's going on in Europe and Japan. And, you know, they look suspect at China. So I think there are major, major changes coming. And this will unfold over years. But again, I think it's an inflection point. The nature of inflation, the nature of economic structure, and the nature of finance will be evolving over time.
So we've got two potential tells in the marketplace. What are commodity prices in the first quarter of 2017 telling you? What are the credit markets signaling, whether that's corporate credit or European sovereign debt? What do you see in these pockets that might be foretelling where the rest of 2017 goes?
I think there'll be enormous pressure on the ECB to wind down QE. You know, the Germans were opposed to this policy. They have been opposed for years now. I think they probably made an agreement last year. Okay, this is the last shot at QE to get things turned around. So I think European QE will wind down at the end of this year. We're already seeing signs of this, I think, because we've seen really a blowout in spreads in the European periphery. And I always look at the periphery. That's the canary in the mine. So the periphery is saying they expect waning liquidity in Europe. So you're seeing significantly higher yields, wider spreads in Italy, France. The spread between France and Germany, the sovereign spread, is, I think, the widest in 5 or 6 years now. So to me, that's an early indication that the market sense not only is there political instability, there's a real risk in ECB policymaking. So that's key. I think we're seeing now a lot of confusion in Chinese policymaking circles as far as what they do to rein in their credit bubble. I think they're going to have to tighten significantly this year. So I think that'll be a major development. And I think the Japanese, especially now with rising global yields, they're going to have to admit that they cannot peg their 10-year yield down near zero. That would lead to, you know, enormous inflation of their central bank balance sheet and all types of distortions in the marketplace.
So shifting to kind of your workaday life, if establishing a short position is not defined by calling a market top, what types of internal market metrics help you when you're deciding to put on a position?
Sure. I want to see some waning, I'll call it risk embracement. I want to see some nervousness. I want to see small signs of less risk taking, of some de-risking, deleveraging. So I look at a lot of liquidity indicators. I'm watching a lot of credit spreads, a lot of CDS pricing. So far, you know, we're seeing some underperformance in the small cap stocks, for example. That's an early indication. That's another one of these indicators at the periphery. We're also seeing somewhat of a narrowing. Right now, you see very speculative markets in technology, biotech, some of the NASDAQ financials, et cetera. And that can kind of be a sign also that you're getting close to the end when you get more of a crowding into the really hot sectors. So I'm looking for underperformance. I'm comfortable shorting, even if the general market's flat to mildly rising, as long as I see some underperformance in some key sectors, certainly some key stocks.
You designed the McIlvany Wealth Management Tactical Short for institutions. Is it an offering that only has relevance for an institution or pension fund?
No. Certainly, you know, we think there's a place for it with institutions. They have these broad portfolios of risk assets, and we would like to be a component of that to reduce their overall portfolio volatility and provide some downside protection. We think that's really critical today for the institutional investor. But also there are individuals that we can work with that have a need for some downside protection, have a need for a non-correlating asset in their portfolio to help hedge against not only, you know, stock prices that they might be long, you know, an equity portfolio, they may be long corporate debt, all types of risk assets, because right now everything's highly correlated. So we're happy to work with, you know, individuals that are qualified for our type of investment strategy.
Managing them in separately managed accounts as opposed to in a fund, which is a little bit more opaque in terms of the positioning and a little bit more distance in terms of liquidity. What other flexibilities do you see gained from that kind of a structure as opposed to a fund? And on the other side of that, do you foresee offering some kind of a strategy like this as a mutual fund at some point? Not a hedge fund, but a mutual fund where, you know, Mr. Joe Sixpack can own $5,000-$10,000 of it if he wanted to down the line.
Sure. And first, on the separately managed accounts, we chose to begin with this strategy. We really like the flexibility that this provides our investors. And I'll tell you, when we sat down and conceptualized this product, it was never a case, okay, what product can we introduce and make a lot of money from? It was always driven by, what product would make the most sense, be the most advantageous for investors? So it's very important. We want our investors to be in a short product that's liquid, that's transparent, that has lower fees, because we want to build a long-term business. We're looking for long-term relationships. We think we can be part of a portfolio for years. And as we, you know, have a proven track record and grow our assets, then we'll do quite nicely. But we like this product because we think it's a very appealing product for investors, especially in this environment. Yeah, down the road, we would love to have a product that would cater more to someone that has a smaller portfolio but still wants to protect themselves. I've always been committed to trying to provide a product to help people, especially during these bubble periods where so many people get blindsided and they have nowhere to turn. They've been convinced that the markets always go up, and all of a sudden they just see their wealth disappear, you know, lose so much money in the markets again. So we would like to have different products suitable for, you know, investors through the whole spectrum.
Yeah, we talked about a short position and really not being as important to call a market top. But how would you grade the timing of the launch of the MWM tactical short? Is this a time frame that makes more sense than another? Why now versus, say, 5 years ago, 10 years ago? Why don't we wait just a couple of years and see how this plays out?
Yeah, I think the timing's fortunate. I've been on a, we'll call it a sabbatical for the last couple of years, you know, continuing to follow the markets closely and riding, but knowing that this was not an environment where I wanted to start a new short product, I think now is a great time. Again, we're seeing major inflection points unfold here in some fundamentals, and I don't think it'll be too awfully long until the markets have to come to terms with the changing environment.
Yeah, we've planned a conference call just around the corner, March 30th. If people are interested in learning more about the MWM tactical short that you're managing, what do they need to do? What do you hope to cover in that time frame?
Yeah, I hope people take an interest and jump on the call. We'll have the information on our website to give the details and just sign up and then call in. And my plan is I'll start with an overview of the product. It's very important to provide information on the investment philosophy, go somewhat granular in the investment process. I want to talk a bit about the environment and why I think this is a very good time to start thinking about, you know, hedging some market risk, getting some protection. And what we want to do also is we want to address questions. We know this is a unique offering, unique environment. We know people will have questions, and we're hoping people will, you know, write them down and email them in. And, you know, I plan on going down the list and answering as many as possible. And if we don't have time to answer all of them, then we'll get answers one way or the other.
Doug, I have a number of mentors. There's a bunch of them that have been dead for 600 or 700 years, and it's their books that give me access to ideas and valuable insights. I have a real live free market mentor. To some degree, over the last decade, you've been my credit market mentor. And as I've read the Credit Bubble Bulletin week in and week out over the last decade, there was this idea that I would love to work with Doug Noland at some point, some way, somehow. And so here we are with a convergence in our interests in the market. And I think this is an exceptional opportunity from a timing standpoint. But even more than that, the exceptional opportunity is that we've got the ideas and the people and the capital all lining up at the same time. And I'm very excited about the tactical short, very excited about the next 10, 20 years of getting to work with you and in building something that is value added for investors, institutions all over the world. So thanks for joining the team. Thanks for joining the conversation today.
David, thank you so much. And I want to repeat, I'm the luckiest guy in the world. And thanks so much for working with me on this. This is awesome.
Thank you for listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary with our guest today, Doug Noland. If you'd like to see the 4 videos on Doug Noland's strategy, go to the site mwealthm.com. Go ahead and watch those videos. If you would like to join the conversation and ask Doug questions, there will be a conference call. That's taking place at the end of the month, March 30th. There are some spaces still available. It has to be pre-registered for, though, so go to mwealthm.com to do that registration.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.